a garden not too far from Jerusalem. In that garden is a tomb. This tomb, in keeping with first century Jewish convention, is probably something like a cave. And it's open, is this tomb. And sitting inside it are, of all things, two angels, two heavenly visitors. But there's more going on in this garden than just a couple of angels sitting inside a tomb. Outside the tomb, probably pretty close to it, are a man and a woman engaged in conversation. And so that's the scene. It's as simple as that. That's what I want you to picture as we begin our sermon this morning. But actually, in the three verses we're looking at, the tomb and its angelic occupants no longer hold much interest for John. They recede into the background, and all the attention falls on the man and the woman. Who are this man and woman? Well, the woman is Mary Magdalene, and the man is Jesus. And as we zoom in on them then, there are two areas that I want us to explore. And first of all, how Jesus relates to Mary. That's the first thing. How Jesus relates to Mary. Jesus relates to Mary here with great tenderness and affection and intimacy. Now, I know that the words intimate and intimacy are sometimes used in sexual contexts. So let me say immediately, and it needs to be said, given all the nonsense about Jesus and Mary Magdalene that has found its way into popular culture, there is nothing of that in this relationship, not here in John 20, not anywhere else either. So I'm not using the word intimacy with a sexual connotation. Please, please be clear on that. But with that qualification in place, I think it's a good word. It's a good word for how Jesus relates to Mary here. And notice with me two things then. First of all, a beautiful intimacy. A beautiful intimacy. Our text begins with Jesus speaking Mary's name. Jesus said to her, Mary, verse 16. Now that may not seem to us a big thing, but part of the reason why it may not seem to us a big thing is that we're diving in here to the middle of the passage. If, however, you read from the start of the chapter, or even actually just from verse 11, you feel the power of Mary being addressed by name, because twice in the preceding verses, she hasn't been. Twice, she has been addressed simply as woman. Woman, why are you weeping? The angels have asked her in verse 13. And woman, why are you weeping? Jesus has also asked her, verse 15, still at that point, acting as a random stranger and withholding his true identity. To address a woman in that way in first century culture wasn't rude. If you're a female visitor here this morning and in the foyer after the service, I said to you, woman, where are you from? Then you probably wouldn't think much of my manners. In the culture we're dealing with here, it wasn't rude, but it was distant. There was a lack of warmth about it. Hang on a minute, Dan, you may be thinking, doesn't Jesus on a couple of occasions in this gospel, in fact, address his mother using this word woman? Well, yes, he does. Was his relationship with his mother a distant one then, lacking much warmth? Well, no, I'm sure it wasn't, and I'm sure indeed that woman was not his customary way of addressing his mother. There were reasons he did so on those two occasions. When he addressed her in that way at the wedding in Cana, it was right at the start of his public ministry. Mary was having to learn that Jesus now operated at two different levels. At one level, he was Jesus the carpenter from Nazareth. And in that connection, she had a special status and she had a special privilege. She was his mother. But then at another level, he was Jesus the Messiah. And in that connection, she was just another person who, like everyone else, stood in need of his saving work. And it was to help her to grasp that second level then, that Jesus, about to do something messianic and turn water into wine, addressed her then as woman. when he addressed her in that way at the cross. We looked at that passage a few weeks ago on the morning I coughed and spluttered my way through the sermon. He was in the act of entrusting Mary to a new son, to John, because he, Jesus, of course, would soon be gone. In that context, it just wouldn't have been helpful for him to call her mother. It wouldn't have aided this transition that Jesus was trying to accomplish. It would only have highlighted to Mary that the dying man in front of her, Jesus, was her son, not this other man to the side of her, John. So Jesus there called her woman. Now, I'm laboring that point a bit, and I hope I haven't lost you here, but the point I'm really trying to make is that woman then is a fairly cool and impersonal way of addressing someone. And the double occurrence of it here in this garden then makes for a gloriously stark contrast when we get to verse 16 and suddenly it's dropped. And Jesus speaks Mary Magdalene's name. Mary, he calls, not woman. Because to him, she's not just a woman, indistinguishable from all the other members of the female sex. No, she's a particular woman. In her individuality, he knows her, and in her individuality, she matters to him. It isn't just the race to which she belongs that matters to him, or the category to which she belongs, or the class to which she belongs, or the group to which she belongs, or whatever. No, she herself matters to him. This specific person with her own personality and her own appearance and her own mannerisms and her own way of thinking and her own name. She matters to Jesus. And so it isn't woman or thingamajig or what's your face. It's Mary. That's the word on Jesus' lips here. And it's fascinating that immediately, Mary's idea that this guy standing near her is the gardener, that just goes right out of the window, doesn't it? She knows, immediately, she knows it's Jesus. Him calling her Mary is enough. I mean, in the next section that we'll come to another time, Jesus says to his disciples, "Peace be with you," verse 19. But "peace be with you" is the standard greeting in Jewish society. That doesn't identify this man in their midst as Jesus. Any Tom, Dick or Harry trying to impersonate Jesus might say that. So they need further ID. They need him to show them his hands and his side. Mary doesn't. Him calling her Mary is enough. Which suggests, number one, that this is how she was accustomed to him addressing her. It's not some wave of post-resurrection euphoria that's causing him to be uncharacteristically amiable in this garden. No, he often spoke to Mary in this warm and personal way. And number two, it suggests that others didn't often speak to her in that way. Perhaps she carried the stigma of her troubled past, plagued, Luke tells us, by seven demons. Perhaps that inclined people to keep their distance somewhat from Mary and to hold her somewhat at arm's length. So Jesus commonly called her Mary. Others didn't call her Mary. And if this man then was calling her Mary, she didn't need to conduct further security checks on him. She didn't need to make absolutely sure it was him. She knows. She knew it was him. It had to be him. Only in him was there that kind of tender affection that valued her very name. And thrilled then at that tender affection, and thrilled that it hadn't, as she thought, been lost forever, swallowed up in death on the Friday afternoon. Thrilled at that, Mary responds, it seems, in a natural and instinctive way. In addition to her cry, "Rabboni," she grabs hold of Jesus in fervent embrace. The text doesn't say that explicitly, but it's required in order to make sense of Jesus' next words, "Do not cling to me." It's a bit of a random thing for him to say, unless at that moment, clinging to him is the very thing that Mary is doing. Not that Jesus is rebuking Mary for doing that. The next bit of his sentence is crucial. For I have not yet ascended to the Father. The way Mary is holding on to him, she seems to fear that if she lets go, then he'll disappear and she'll never see him again. No, that's not the case, Jesus is assuring her. The time for my ascension, when I shall disappear, that's not yet. I'm going to be around for a bit longer, Mary. There'll be other opportunities for you to see me and to spend time with me. You don't need to grab hold of me in quite this way. That's the spirit of those words. Do not cling to me. He's not saying, don't you dare cling to me, Mary. It's terribly beneath my dignity. When you've experienced resurrection like I have, then you're too special to be touched by ordinary people like you. No, rather he's saying with a twinkle in his eye, steady on, Mary. You don't have to forcibly detain me, you know, like I'm about to slip away into heaven. I have not yet ascended to the Father. And so I hope you're getting a sense of the beautiful intimacy of this scene, the intensely personal form of address, Mary. The instant association in Mary's mind of such warmth and affection with Jesus. The ensuing physical contact as Jesus is clung to. The gentle assurance from him of further opportunities for this kind of thing in the near future. Beautiful intimacy. And you know, this points us to a crucial aspect of the Christian life. Because when you're a Christian, Jesus isn't just your Savior who rescues you from sin. He isn't just your Lord who owns you and dictates your behavior. He isn't just your teacher who shapes all your thinking about reality. He isn't just your King who ordains and arranges all the circumstances of your life. He isn't just your role model in whose footsteps you seek to walk. He is all of those things, but he's also your beloved, whose heart bursts with the deepest affection for you. Perhaps, believer, you've become so busy and distracted in your life that you don't even realize it, but each day he's calling your name. As you're rushing about here and there, as you're fretting about this and that, he's calling your name with all his heart, wanting you to respond like Mary in joyful recognition and for now just figuratively, but one day literally, grasp hold of him. That's what he wants. Frequent, tender interaction with you. Yes, you heard me right, with you. With you. That's what he wants. As a Christian, you've been brought not only into the realm of Jesus' forgiveness and protection and intercession, you've been brought into the realm of Jesus' intimacy. Make the most of it, believer. For several years, we didn't realize that our BT package included BT Sport. It was an unused benefit. We were using the bog standard benefits of our BT package, making telephone calls and going online and all that kind of stuff, but we were missing out on the really desirable benefits, Premier League and Champions League football matches. Don't let an intimate relationship with Jesus Christ be an unused benefit in your Christianity, because it's the really desirable one. Of all the many, many, many benefits, intimacy with the Lord Jesus Christ is the really desirable one. So a beautiful intimacy. But then notice too, a balanced intimacy. A balanced intimacy. So there's Mary grasping onto Jesus with all her might. And he says, do not cling to me. And we said that's because she doesn't need to cling to him. He's going to be around for a while. There'll be further opportunities. And that's absolutely true. But notice there's another reason Jesus says that line. It's not just that she doesn't need to stay in that garden with her arms around Jesus. It's also that she does need to be doing something else. Do not cling to me, for I've not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, So, Jesus' affection for Mary that we've just been talking about is real and marvelous. And Mary may enjoy it. She should enjoy it. She should revel in it. However, she mustn't revel in Jesus' affection at the expense of and to the exclusion of Jesus' brothers. Jesus' brothers here, of course, are not his genealogical brothers, Jesus and Mary's other sons with whom he grew up in Nazareth. He's talking about his disciples. That's who he means. And these men, then, they are presently down the road in Jerusalem. And they're in quite a pickle. They're fearful. John will tell us that in verse 19. And doubtless they're also confused. They know by now that the tomb is empty because Peter and John have reported it. But none of them really has anything more than that to go on. One of them, John, now believes that Jesus has risen. But he may not have had the confidence at this point to try to persuade the others of that. And even if he does have the confidence, it's going to seem to them a pretty precarious conclusion to make on the basis of a folded up face cloth. So these guys, they're in a bad way, I'm saying. And Mary now is in a position to help them. She has more than just a folded up face cloth to go on. She has an actual encounter with Jesus himself to tell those men about. They desperately need to hear her story. And so this intimacy then that she's experiencing in the garden, it's proper and it's beautiful, but it mustn't become so all-consuming that she neglects those needy disciples down the road. Her own enjoyment of Jesus must be balanced by a sense of responsibility to Jesus' followers. The Jesus who says so tenderly, Mary, also says quite firmly, go to my brothers. And that kind of balanced intimacy is what should mark every Christian life. You know, it isn't the height of piety to lock yourself away 24/7 in non-stop Bible study and prayer as though you're the only Christian in the world. No, the Jesus with whom you're locking yourself away has brothers. Imagine you're a young man and you begin courting a girl. And one day you say to her, look, I adore you and I want to spend as much time with you as possible, but I'm not remotely interested in your siblings. Can we please stay well clear of them? The girl probably isn't going to be all that happy with you saying that. It might even spell the end of the courtship. And Jesus is similarly unsympathetic towards such sentiments coming from Christians. I love you, Lord, but I can't be bothered with those that you call your brothers. I can't be bothered with other Christians. We must all beware that attitude. Yes, there's a time for embracing Jesus in bouts of intense devotion. There's a time for that. But there's also a time for ministering to Jesus' brothers. It might be a practical kind of ministering, helping a believer whose capacities are impaired by ill health or old age. It might be a pastoral kind of ministering, as Mary's needed to be here, helping a believer who's struggling with sin or with assurance of salvation or whatever it might be. But I'm saying there's a time for that too. For leaving the peaceful garden where you're alone with Jesus and getting yourself amongst other Christians who need your help. Let me put it this way. Let me give you two texts which we must all hold together side by side. Text number one, Revelation 3:20, you all know it. Words of Jesus, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone, singular, hears my voice and opens a door, I will come in to him, singular, and eat with him and he with me. So Jesus wants individual communion with you. But then text number two, Hebrews 3:12-13. See to it, brothers, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God, but encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. We're to be daily, daily, ensuring that through our encouragements, our fellow believers keep going in the Christian life and don't turn away from the living God. The two emphases represented by those two texts, they're not either or emphases, they are both and emphases. They're equally essential components of the Christian life. So, how Jesus relates to Mary then? He relates to her with intimacy, an intimacy that is beautiful, but an intimacy that is also balanced in the way that I've just explained. But let's move now from how Jesus relates to Mary to, secondly, what Jesus reports through Mary. What Jesus reports through Mary. So I said just now that Jesus' brothers, his disciples there in Jerusalem, are fearful and confused, and that Mary, therefore, is to go and help them. And we discover in the second half of verse 17 that it's something very specific that Jesus wants to report to those brothers through Mary. "Go to my brothers," he says, "and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Let's break that down a bit. Notice, first of all, the verb. The verb, "I am ascending." I am ascending. It seems strange, doesn't it, for Jesus here to focus on that. Some of these men to whom he's sending this report in that room in Jerusalem, they probably still suspect that Jesus is lying dead somewhere. It isn't Jesus' next moves that they need to hear about. It's just the sheer fact that he's risen, that he's alive again. It's what's happened that morning, surely, that they need to hear about, not what's going to happen a little bit further down the line, Jesus ascending up into heaven. I have risen. Surely that should be the message. Not, I am ascending. Mary actually has to improvise a bit, doesn't she, when she goes to the disciples there in verse 18. She has to add that bit, that I have seen the Lord. So why doesn't Jesus include that himself in the report that he sends to these men? Why does he focus on the fact that he's about to ascend? Why that verb? Well, I suspect that it provides us with a little window into Jesus' own thinking and into what is exciting him at this moment. You see, now that his death and resurrection are behind him, his ascension must feel so close. It's the next thing for him now. You're a pupil at school. It's almost the end of the summer term. You break up on Friday. But on Wednesday, there's a big maths test. And so you're beavering away then, preparing for that maths test on Wednesday. The test then comes. It lasts for the hour or whatever it's supposed to last. And then it ends. And even as you walk out of that room, all that's on your mind now is the summer holidays. The remaining couple of days are irrelevant because they contain no test. That's past now. The test itself is already receding into the background. You're about to break up. That thought now dominates your whole psyche. And I think it's a bit like that for Jesus here. He walks out of that tomb like you walking out of that exam room. The one thought of going to his Father now dominating his whole psyche. He's been building up to the cross. All through the upper room discourse, it was on his mind. He's been building up to the cross and the resurrection. It's now past. And the one thing now that he can think of, ascension. Ascension. It's not happening today or tomorrow or even the next day. It's a few weeks away, but it's dominating his psyche now. Do you remember those words that Jesus speaks back in chapter 14, verse 28? He says there, from the middle of that verse, "If you love me," speaking to his disciples, "if you love me, you would have rejoiced, because I am going to the Father, for the Father is greater than I." The last part of that verse is sometimes grotesquely misunderstood, as though Jesus is saying that the Father is more God than I am, the Father is more divine than I am. That would be blatantly incompatible with loads of other material in this very gospel. I and the Father are one, John 10, verse 30. All that the Father has is mine, chapter 16, verse 15. Jesus was calling God his Father, making himself equal with God, chapter 5, verse 18. No, the point that he's making is this. God the Son is at this juncture living in a context of humiliation, whereas God the Father is not. And Jesus is saying there then, look, you mustn't think that my Father inhabits some shabby dwelling the way that I presently do. You mustn't think that my Father is ignored and mistaken by onlookers the way that I presently am. No, he dwells amidst glory and splendor in heaven. He is adored permanently by angelic onlookers. His whole setting is immeasurably greater than mine. That's the point Jesus is making. But I'm going back there. And I'm going to be reinstated into that setting. And I'm going to share with him again in all of its majesty. That's what's exciting him there, and that's what's exciting him here then. And that's why he comes out of the tomb, not saying, look everyone, I'm alive, but saying, it's ascension time. It's exciting him, this return to the Father. And of course, there's something else interesting there in chapter 14, verse 28, isn't there? If you loved me, you would have rejoiced because I am going to the Father. Don Carson comments insightfully on that. He says, to this point, the disciples have responded emotionally entirely according to their perception of their own gain or loss. If they had loved Jesus, they would have perceived that his departure was his gain and rejoiced with him at that prospect. As it is, their grief is an index of their self-centeredness. And as those then in this room who love Jesus, even this morning amidst our own struggles, can't we derive some satisfaction and pleasure from the thought he is with his Father? He is with his Father. Last Sunday evening, I talked a little about the parable of the lost son and the way that that son is smothered with gifts and blessings as he returns home. If that's how God treats returning rebels who have shamefully run off to a far country, how must he have received back into his bosom the returning Jesus, who had nobly ventured into a far country in order to rescue rebels in obedience to his Father? With what intensity of feeling must the Father have then ushered him into his throne and said, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? Isn't it thrilling to think of our Jesus being treated that way? To be sure, the best is still to come for Jesus when his enemies will have been made a footstool for his feet. But he's already experiencing such pleasures, as Psalm 16:11 puts it, such pleasures at God's right hand. What a thought. Our Jesus, our beloved Savior, experiencing pleasures right now at God's right hand. So that's the verb. Then notice secondly the titles in this report that Jesus is sending. The titles. There in chapter 14, 28, he talks exclusively, doesn't he, Jesus, of going to the Father. That's where he's going. And here too, he uses that title. He says, I am ascending to my Father. And given who Jesus is, then that's unsurprising. We're not surprised to see him using that title. But he adds another. To my God. To my Father. To my God. Now, we can easily pass over that title without thinking about it. That is a title that is only appropriate for Jesus to use by virtue of the humanity that he has taken on. Prior to becoming a human, in the incarnation as we call it, Jesus didn't relate to the Father as his God. He simply was God. Jesus. And that was the end of the matter. I mean, to have a God is to be creaturely and subordinate, isn't it? And once then God the Son took human nature. Two things then were simultaneously true of him. Both that he was God, because he hadn't discarded his divine nature, but now also he had a God. That's why he prayed. We often encounter Jesus praying, don't we, in the Gospels? Prayer, by definition, is you addressing the one who is your God. In one famous prayer, of course, he uses that very language. My God, why have you forsaken me? So, the title, my God, it's only appropriate for Jesus by virtue of the humanity that he has assumed. But surely then that's going to change with his ascension. Surely he's going to revert to the situation where he is simply God and doesn't also have a God. He doesn't relate to someone else as his God. Well, no. He's not going to revert to that situation. He makes it quite clear here that these two things are still going to be true of him after the ascension. Still, he's going to be God and also have a God. Still, he's going to be fully divine, but also fully human, and in that humanness, still subordinate. Still someone who relates to the Father as his God. What an extraordinary thought. Let me just say this in connection with it. It means that the Lord Jesus relates to our worship in a twofold way. At one level, he is the worshipped. And it's impossible to overstate the importance of that. That's what, more than anything else, defines us as Christians, that we worship Jesus. That, more than anything else, is what we do as we gather on these occasions on the Lord's Day. We worship Jesus because he is absolutely equal with the Father. But at another level, he is a worshipper with us because he's still a man who relates to the Father as his God. And still at that level, he is subordinate. Indeed, it's an emphasis in the Psalms, the Messianic Psalms, that the Messiah, having suffered and having been exalted, he will then lead God's people in their worship of God. Remember there, Psalm 22, verse 22. This is Jesus speaking about his exalted existence. I will tell of your name. He's speaking to his Father, who is also his God. I will tell of your name to my brothers in the midst of the congregation. I will praise you. Jesus, still a worshipper, praising God in his exalted states. That's quoted in Hebrews 2 of all places. Hebrews 1 has set out the fact that we worship Jesus. He's the worshipped. In Hebrews 2, you have Jesus himself, still a worshipper. Remarkable thing. It's also there in Psalm 18 that we sang. Psalm 18 verse 49, which, as I said, is quoted in relation to Jesus in Romans 15 verse 9. And this one is even more relevant to us, because there you have Jesus saying again of his exalted state, I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations and sing to your name. Among the nations, among the Gentiles. That's us. Always fascinates me at football matches, the singing in the crowd, and sometimes you see some guy in the crowd and he tries to start the whole crowd singing something, and it just doesn't take off, and he ends up looking pretty silly. Isaac and Fraser and I were at a game the other day, and there was a guy who was doing that, and initially it just didn't take off, and he kept on going and kept on going, and by the end of it he had several hundred people around him singing the same song as him. And the picture in Psalm 18:49, taken up by Paul in Romans 15:9, it's the picture of Jesus singing now in this, in his exalted state, singing in praise to God and being joined by more and more and more and more of a crowd of other singers around him. Among the nations I will sing you. It's the picture of a bigger and bigger and bigger choir been assembled. Jesus started it all. And throughout these last days, throughout this period until he comes, more and more people are joining in his song of praise to his God and our God. Edmund Clowney, who's a 20th century American theologian, he puts it very well. He writes, "Every time you sing in the fellowship of God's people, Jesus Christ is holding your hymn book, and he's singing as it were with you and over your shoulder and leading you in the worship of God." We need to reflect on that, this dual thing going on in our gatherings. Yes, we worship Jesus, unambiguously we do, but also we worship the Father with Jesus, and he leads us in that worship of the one who still, as a man, is his God. The verb, the titles, and then just very quickly, in this report Jesus sends, also the pronouns. The pronouns. So Jesus doesn't just speak in terms of my, does he? I'm going to my Father and your Father. Sorry, my Father, my God. But also he says, your Father, your God. He uses that pronoun as well. That's what his death and resurrection have achieved. Extraordinarily, they have brought these men sitting in that locked room in Jerusalem, and they have brought the death and resurrection have brought us into the same relationship with God that Jesus himself has, so that whatever pronouns he can use in relation to God, we can use them too. But notice that the logic that Jesus is assuming here in this sentence. He's basically, that the logic is this, that I belong in the presence of the one who is my Father and my God. Because he seems to kind of put forward the fact that God is his Father and his God as the reason he has to ascend to him. I belong in the presence of the one who is my Father and my God. That's where I must be. I can be away from there for a period, out of necessity, to do some work. But ultimately, that's where I must be. I must be in the presence of the one who is my Father and my God. And when then he adds, your Father, your God, the same logic is extended to us. We too belong in the presence of the one who is our Father and our God. We too can be away for a period of time. We are now. We're in a Psalm 63 verse 1 situation right now. Earnestly I seek you, my soul thirsts for you, my body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. We're not in God's presence as long as we live this present life. But ultimately, we must be there in the presence of the one who was our God and Father. There's a kind of magnetic pull. It's almost like these pronouns have a magnetism about them, and they pull you into the presence of the one who is your God and your Father. Jesus says, I must be where the one who is my God and Father is. And we too must end up in the place where our God and our Father is. Is that not an encouraging thought with which to close this morning? In a world that's so messy, so full of toil, so full of sin, so full of sorrow, that we can say of God, my Father. And anybody who can use that pronoun, my, must end up where he is, in his very presence. In Psalm 23 terms, God will not always walk with us through the valley of the shadow of death. He will not always lay a table for us in the midst of our enemies. But we can also sing, goodness and mercy all my life shall surely follow me, and in God's house forevermore my dwelling place shall be. If you can use the word my of God this morning, then God's house is your destiny. That's where you're heading. Look beyond all the things that are worrying you about this week, all the things that are in your diary and you wish they weren't in your diary. Look beyond those. Your destiny is the house of God where you will dwell forevermore. It has to be. He's your God. He's your Father. Jesus had to ascend. You have to ascend. You have to end up there. Be encouraged. Your destiny is the presence of your God and Father. Amen. Let's close singing that psalm from the hymn book, 787. The Lord's my shepherd, I'll not want. He makes me down to lie. And especially let's enjoy those closing lines that are so beautiful. 787, to God's praise.